This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. So, will the U.S. Consumer Confidence Index be above 101 in March 2026? At IBKR Forecast Trader, the yes recently priced at 40% and no at 58%, but markets move fast. Forecast contracts let you turn your views into trades on future events like the economy, climate changes, and politics with very, very simple yes or no prediction style contracts. Explore trending data, spot the trends, and if you get your prediction right, you earn $1 per contract at settlement. Plus, you'll earn 3.14% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon, and you'll get $3 for signing up with IBKR Forecast Trader, which you can use for any purpose or to start trading. Forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Go to IBKR.com/forecast and turn your views into IBKR Forecast Trader contracts today. The last trading day for this contract is March 22nd.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
War and markets, not a great mix. South Korea tumbles the most in history. Inflation risk is real again, and the Fed's quandary is getting worse. And our guest today, Ross Gerber of Gerber Kawasaki. All this and much more on episode number 963 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Always something these days, isn't it? I mean, the good news is that investors, well, they love their stocks. We love stocks. In fact, it doesn't really matter seemingly if there's a war or something going on in Mexico or maybe even an oil embargo, an issue with energy around the world. Yes, the lows of the days held and bounced back extraordinarily on U.S. stocks. And we've seen several days of these crazy moves just this week after the missiles were flying over the Middle East. But generally what we saw, if you look at this, in fact, it looks like the trail of a missile when you look at the actual stock on a bar candle style a chart where you see that the lows were down, these long tails, we call it, and then right back up to the top. Each day that we saw the sell-off this week, there was a little bit of damage done, yes, but not so much. I mean, we're talking about this horrible feeling, this crazy amount of risk, the volatility VIX moving up to 24.5 or 25. And we're talking about 2 to 3% off of the recent highs on most indices in the U.S. Lots of long tails, lots of continued interest in buying. U.S. stocks were the ones, again, that we were looking at. Around the world, a little bit different. Traders picked up buying at the bottoms. No real technicals that were flashing any signals. Just price action, at least as I see it. It was all this, oh my God, it's down so much, let's buy. It wasn't like, oh, it hit the 50-day moving average and bounced. Or the 200, the 150, the 100. Or it wasn't like, oh, the MACD was showing that a conversion divergence into the upside should be played. Or maybe the R squared or the stochastics or the Bollinger Bands or whatever you want to say. The fact is that it was all about, boy, this looks like it's really sold off a lot. I'm going to buy in now. Kind of interesting. But some things were decisively sold. I got to tell you something. When we look at, for example, wow, the KOSPI, Korean stock market. Now remember something. This market was up about 150% or so last year, which is an extraordinary number for a developed nation. You don't usually see something like that unless it's Venezuela that has inflation at 1,000% per year. The KOSPI last year was the epicenter of the tech trade. the opportunity for a very small market capitalized index to gather and garner all sorts of money and an interest, thereby pushing it up dramatically. Then the momentum traders took over and it was off to the races. Followed through this year with another 50% increase in the first 2 months of this year until all of a sudden there was a sell-off that was due to what? Well, the Middle East conflict. It was kind of interesting what happened here. We had a few historic days. One day, I think it was on Wednesday, their Wednesday, 12% drop for the market, numerous market halts. And why was that? Well, we had an overbought, a fundamentally overdone, kind of a over the skis kind of situation. And once there was a hiccup with investors who probably had an incredible amount of margin leverage in that market, they said, the hell with this, I'm out. And because, again, small capitalized markets and a lot of money moving in, moving out, it was exacerbated because of a lot of different things. One of the problems is that many countries like South Korea really doesn't have oil. They're reliant on others. And who are they reliant on? Well, in this case, it's places like the Middle East, Iran, etc. And when you see that they are freaking out because of a potential energy emergency, things go a little crazy. And then you add to that the excessive margin that's on the account and the leverage in the system and the momentum players falling over each other, trying to get in and now trying to get out. There's people that are left, you know, hanging dry. The rug was pulled. India is another example of a market that does an incredible amount of reliance externally for oil. And by the way, if you didn't see it, there was something else that happened. Europe is now in a pickle. The problem is that in Qatar, one of the largest liquid natural gas LNG producers and exporters, about 20% of the world's LNG, is shut down because of the bombings, etc. That is causing a major crimp, and it's still wintertime. We're starting to work into spring here. I know it's the beginning of March, but we're working into spring, but yet still winter, still cold, still use of heating fuels, of natural gas, of course, for factories and other things like that, but also for heating. That price skyrocketed. The LNG price and heating oil, I mean, we saw LNG prices go up 60% in one day. I'm talking about European natural gas, the natural gas on their markets. So that's a big, big, big story. The Straits of Hormuz is closed, and even with the backdrop, the promises of President Trump offering insurance and maybe even escorts, Navy escorts through the Straits of Hormuz, there's a lot of concern that we're going to see oil rising in price. And what's interesting is that oil did already rise in price, but it wasn't, you know, it's not that big of a deal. It's just not that big of a deal. We didn't see oil really skyrocket. There was some concern about a $20 move. It moved what? I don't know. The range was $15, $14. Still not in a place that's, you know, above 80. It's not above 80. It's fine right now. And with that in mind, the concern that everybody had about this huge increase, it's not happening at the moment. At the moment, things can change. There's some reports midweek that talked about how Iran may be out of their missile capability. Then what? They're going to be left all alone. They have drones. But then they're sitting there. They pissed off everybody in the region. And who knows how fast this thing's going to shut down, especially if there's no government, no leadership, no ability to really coordinate any of this, which is, you know, that was the goal, right? That was the goal, to cut the head off the serpent and to reestablish what's going on there and have basically a regime change that can be much more friendly, and we'll see how that goes. You know, this is a little bit different because there's a lot of religious issues going on with this. It's not just simply a leader that's a strong man. This is a religious cleric, the holy that was taken out and due to Sharia law and the way that they work there, you know, it's a little bit of a different environment. But like I said, not easy to point out, but basically, we could all say there's a lot going on. And rightfully so, volatility measures are heightened, but there's a lot of opportunity. Don't forget that. A lot of opportunity on all sides of this trade, whether it's the short side, the long side, a lot of opportunity. I'm going to say it again, because I don't want you to forget it. I want you to recognize that this is not about fear and freaking out. We had some people call us last week, wondering about this, and nobody was freaking out or were worried to a point that they were, you know, like, oh my God, I got to do something bad. But, you know, people naturally get concerned, upset about this. Now, it also depends on how long you've been investing. If you're new to investing, you're probably a lot more worried, concerned about what's going on. If you're an old hat at it, you've seen that wars in particular are those things that initially are shocks to the system, but then they kind of, we get used to it. And that takes some time, and hopefully we're not going to go that long with this particular conflict. But if we do, that's the progression. Unless something comes home on our turf. But the crazy thing that you have to understand about war is that war in its perverse way is actually good economically in some degrees. Clearly, even if you are the recipient of the bombs, it may not be good for you, and of course, you as a person, but the rebuild process is actually economically positive. Think about that. The act of actually getting and having bombs built, munitions generated, manufactured, and then the rubble cleared and then rebuilt, all that is an economic benefit to various parties. Something just to think about, as horrible as that may sound. We're going to end there on this note because I want to spend a lot of time with our guest today, and he's a great one and someone who I really respect. Call a friend who is a good friend of the show. Before we do so, I want to talk about Interactive Brokers again because, you know, it's March, right? Tax season. That's where we're on. We're in that zone. And this is a good time to meet Portfolio Analyst from Interactive Brokers, the free all-in-one dashboard that lets you consolidate, track, and analyze all your financial accounts in one place. You don't need to have an IBKR account to use it either. Just connect your accounts and see your complete financial picture, your investments, performance, and allocation all in one single screen. Plan smarter with IBKR's new tax and retirement planners too. These are built around your goals and market assumptions. Get deep portfolio insights with detailed risk assessments and compare performance against more than 300 benchmarks. Plus, manage your with confidence thanks to GIPS. These are verified returns that you can review and benchmark against. Sign up for the free portfolio analyst at ibkr.com/freepa. Now, let me tell you about our guest real quick, and then we'll bring him on. He's waiting in the wings. It's Ross Gerber. He's co-founder and president and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. He oversees Gerber Kawasaki's corporate and investment management operations, as well as serves individual clients. He's become one of the most followed investors on social and on traditional media. His investment ideas and advice have made him a regular in business news and is featured on CNN, CNBC, Fox, Bloomberg, Reuters, you name it, he's been there. He received a BA in communications from the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania with a concentration in business law at the Wharton School of Business. He also completed a second concentration in classical music studies and attended the Grove School of Music, which we're going to talk about. I have some questions for him. Let's bring him on right now. Ross Gerber, how are you? It's been a while.
I'm pretty good. You know, it's been definitely a different week than I would have predicted a month ago, but you know, I'm pretty happy about the success we've been having. So, you know,
it's interesting. Your next week is going to be much different than the week you would have predicted just this week.
Right. And I think that we're sort of entering a new stage of, in some ways, history that is pretty, you know, uncertain what that will look like, you know, a year from now.
Yeah. I want to talk about some of your personal stuff first, do a little warm up, let people know a little bit more about who you are. So we know that you're a musician, you played guitar. And who was, I think I know this answer, but who was your earliest musical inspiration that really set the stage for, I want to do that?
Well, the real story is a little bit, you know, unique in that I had an experience when I was 16. And in that experience, it involved seeing the Woodstock Jimi Hendrix performance on video around 2 a.m. And during that experience, decided that I could not live my life without actually playing music, playing guitar, and playing Jimi Hendrix. So my original inspiration was certainly Jimi Hendrix and still is to this day. And my son's name is Jimmy, spelled J-I-M-I.
Look at that. Now let's go back also and talk about the early days of your music. You played with, the first band you played with was Third Eye. And you played Weekly.
You're digging deep.
What's that?
You're digging deep.
I got
today,
some
huh?
deep stuff here. You played in college. You played a place which was often, to this day, referred to as the Penstitution, the iconic Smokey Joe's. You had a weekly gig, right?
That's right. And I love Smokey Joe's. And, you know, I was back there about 5 years ago, and Paul Ryan still runs it. And I walk in there and I haven't seen him in a long time. And I was like, you know, I'm so-and-so. And he was like, oh my God, how you doing? You want to play tonight? You know, I was like, really?
Right. You have like a certain memory of that spot? Do you have something?
I have 1,000 memories. I learned so much playing music in Philadelphia for guys like Paul and the Irish guys that ran the bars over there and still run the bars over there. And I learned life lessons that a kid who grew up in Bel Air could never learn in Bel Air.
I love it. Now you're with the Danger Band. That's been your band for years.
Well, no, that ended in
with
COVID.
Oh,
yeah.
It did?
Yeah. Unfortunately, when COVID hit, we were sort of at a high. I had just started a new music company too called Cocoon. So we were like, we rented a house in Malibu, turned it into a studio. It was like amazing. The end of 2019 was like an amazing time in my music career, just like building stuff and my band and all this was like coming together. And then COVID hit. And when COVID hit, it was really detrimental to the music industry, obviously. And unfortunately, one of my band members committed suicide, and it was a very, really, really hard thing to deal with in April of 2020. Tracy, rest in peace. And so since then, I've played live twice. And one time I was lucky enough to play with Cisco Adler, a famous artist, and his band. And of course, they make me sound really good. And that was super fun. And I played live once, you know, several years back. But I'm looking to start doing this again, you know, as soon as time allows. I still play every day almost in practice.
That's great.
Yeah, you know, playing live is wonderful. And so I'm kind of trying to figure out a different way to do it. When I built my new office, it's kind of partially a venue.
Yeah, great. Well, if you need anybody in the band, I could do. By the way, I'm a hell of a triangle and tambourine guy.
Well, tambourine has a role. I don't know about the triangle. But we can work with a tambourine.
All right, let's talk about. I have certain things that I put together for our discussion here because I know we can go into a lot of areas. And I want to talk about AI, the revolution, the broader tech landscape, and you've been bullish on NVIDIA's dominance in the AI space, right?
I've been bullish on NVIDIA since I was a little kid.
But. Right, exactly. Since before NVIDIA even knew they were NVIDIA.
That's right. Well, they did know then.
Well, you
know,
no, they knew they
were about video games.
Well, video
just
games.
Video games.
They were second fiddle, my friend, by a long shot.
For who?
No, come on. They would. To the on the motherboard. It was like, what chip do you want? It was Intel.
Well, right. That's true.
That's what I'm saying.
But we used to use PlayStations and Xboxes or whatever. And the NVIDIA PC route was sort of a different gamer route than the console route, which I was kind of a console guy. So it was actually at E3. I was telling my kids about E3 because they don't do that anymore. And it used to be an amazing experience to go, you know? Yeah. And that's where I learned about NVIDIA because they pulled me aside and I said, listen, I'm not interested in chips. I'm interested in games. So the guy goes, no, let me show you because this is going to make games way better. And that's when I invested in NVIDIA. So this was a long time ago. And this was before crypto and everything else that got it really going. And then through Tesla was really when I started understanding where GPUs fit in the autonomy or ultimately what we call the AI equation now. And it was through GPUs, this was now about 10 years ago at CES when Jensen did his presentation, it was like a big epiphany for us. And we put millions of dollars into NVIDIA then. in 2016, and that was about a decade ago, and it's been just a wildly successful investment.
Cost basis, zero. So that's awesome.
Yeah, it's like one. It's like exactly. $1 or $2. Yeah.
So you recently had a CNN appearance, I think it was like 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago, and you talked about the AI trade. You highlighted NVIDIA strength. Here's my question, though. You know, and I think, as a matter of fact, NVIDIA came out this week and talked about that they think that last $30 billion with the B is the last time they're going to invest in OpenAI, which I want to get into that discussion in a minute. But do you see any risks in any of this AI discussion? Like, for example, energy constraints or maybe like with what's going on with Anthropic, it's not totally out there yet, but with Anthropic, with the government, with regulation over investment. I don't know. Something? Is there something that's concerning?
Well, my basic premise right now is everybody's concerned about the CapEx spend, and I don't think they're going to be able to deploy it all that rapidly. So that's my concern, which you I think was the first thing you said, which was around infrastructure.
Right.
And infrastructure in the United States, especially around electricity, is pretty old and poor. And so just the idea that we're going to just like rapidly ramp up energy is not that simple or easy to do. And it's quite expensive to fix and upgrade electrical infrastructure. And so we're in this period of time where electric prices are going up. Here in LA, it was like a 20% increase in electric prices just this year. And it's a big hit. Like I was like, wow, this is a big difference what we're paying per kilowatt hour than what I was paying. So it went from 25 cents to 30 cents. And I was like, wow, you know, like that, like the demand for electricity is huge, but the supply and the ability to ramp this supply is not that easy, and it's quite hard to deploy. So my basic thing is you're in this race to meet the demand for inference and, you know, for AI, and yet, you know, these companies are going to struggle to be profitable because they're going to want to deploy the infrastructure and do all this as rapidly as possible, and it's very expensive to do it this way. So I think that the profits for AI will be more driven in industries like mine, where we can get immediate efficiencies from using AI that are profitable from like day one, versus the actual AI companies, which have a lot of investment to do before they profit. But I think in 5 years, they'll be wildly profitable.
Yeah, but the problem we have right now is that, just stick on the energy issue for a second here, and you talk about the infrastructure build and the amount of money that we're talking about from the hyperscalers that are giving. And again, I want to save this because I have a different part of this discussion about circular and vendor financing. But I have a whole. I've been on this bandwagon for a while. I can't get off it. Somebody should talk me off of it, but I can't get anybody.
I'm going to try to talk you off of it today.
Okay, good. But you know, you talk about this energy situation. Recently, we saw that there's this thing where data centers, hyperscalers are going to need to supply their own energy, right? We were all hoping for this SMR, the small modular reactors, that whole thing with Oklo,
that's not going to happen.
BlueScale. I mean, who knows how long that's going to take, if it's going to take.
5 years to 10 years.
5 years to 10 years, right. So everybody was investing. Yeah. That was a big thing. Talk about the markets, you know, going in advance of things. But where are we going to get the energy to do all this?
We don't have it.
So that's how does that work? Saying. So how does that work then?
So how it works is, so how do I rapidly deploy new energy? Okay. What Elon did was he just bought a bunch of turbines in Memphis, lied to the government, told them they were temporary, and just been running them all full bore all day long. And it's real bad for the environment, you know? So just running like gas turbines, you know, to make energy, you know, it pollutes. And so there's a lot of rules. Now in Texas, there aren't. So you can do these kind of things.
Which is where they moved to, by the way.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But in California, you're not doing anything like that. So the first question is like, how do we increase energy supply rapidly? And the best way to do that is through solar deployment and battery systems. So solar is the cheapest way to get energy quickest with battery systems. So we really like that business, especially battery
The market
storage.
Doesn't like that business, though. Let's be honest. The market's
I don't
thrilled.
Care what the market likes. I'm just saying. I know what.
Just saying from a stock
I know how
standpoint.
It works. Yeah. I, you know, right. But like renewable energy needs battery systems to really get the most efficiency out of it. And battery systems with renewable energy have proven to be the lowest cost, best source of energy. So if we really want to do stuff, we've got to just go all in and start, you know, really deploying things like solar rapidly. And we can. We have the ability to do this. So I think it's just about investment. The second side of it, which I think is harder, is the actual transmission lines and the actual infrastructure. Mm-hmm. This is a whole nother level of difficulty than just putting up solar panels, capturing energy and putting it in a battery or whatever. Now I got to build transmission lines that take this to the place. So if I build my own power around my data center, you know, and then it's a pretty simple process, but that has to be put into the economics of building the data center, which is now I have to build a whole new energy source and transmission for each data center. How much more does it cost to do this? So that's why I say it's going to take more time to deploy the infrastructure than people will want to accept, because there's a lot of like things that have to be done. And then when you go to the city or the county and you say, I want to add my own energy infrastructure here, it's, you know, you got to deal with politicians, which means nothing happens fast.
And the problem you also have, Ross, tell me if I'm wrong about this, is that the energy consumption that we have right now with, we'll call it AI 1, you know, 1.0 conceptually, right? Then moving into inference and then moving into agentic is a whole, it's not just a 1, 2, 3. It's a whole different level of consumption.
It's already like maxed, you know, like we're using Claude a lot here at, you know, at work, and like, it'll be like, okay, you've maxed out your usage today. And yeah. It's like, how much more can we pay? You know? And then it was down the other day because there's just so much demand, and they have to like kind of limit how many tokens you're using. And, you know, a token is kind of like a word. And so like the more questions you ask AI and the more it spits out more data, it costs money. Mm-hmm. And so they're undercharging for this product right now to get everybody to sign up, charging $20 a month. You know, Netflix costs more money and does a lot less for me than AI.
You've talked about this. You've talked about like, you know, Grok and Grok and, you know, it doesn't matter. The other ones we talk about, they're not going to stay cheap forever, right? So right now I'm paying $30 a month for Copilot. Now I know Copilot is
the least good of all.
It's the least, but it does a good job for things like, you know, grammar check this, you know, rewrite this sentence, make sure this email looks good.
You don't have to like cut and paste.
Right. Or look up, find information on this client's information in my work aside, you know, that's all in there. But, do we think that the differential between pricing, where you have AI models and the AI companies that are the open, quote unquote, open source, right? And the for the good of mankind versus the business-based ones, you know, those two competing forces these days, which everybody's starting to move much more towards the other side, forget about the good of mankind. Is this going to start costing us a lot more?
I don't think it's going to be right away, but yeah, for sure. And people will pay a lot more. But you have to look at it like as a cost benefit, you know, like how much am I willing to spend to get huge efficiencies in my business and, you know, not have to hire employees that we were going to hire. So if you just don't hire one employee because of AI, let's say that's saving you $100,000 a year right there. So like, wouldn't you pay $2,000 a month for Claude, you know, and people will, and that's what's going to be, you know? And so companies will pay a lot more than individuals. I think there'll be free versions of these things, obviously, to get, that'll be like ad supported, you know, and then there'll be like the $30 or $50 or however many like tokens you're really using, you know? So it'll be based off usage, because it's kind of like when the internet started and AOL used to charge, you know, $29.99 a month, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that they needed to do that. And when AOL said, okay, we're not going to charge anymore, it was down, you know, like the demand.
I never understood that whole thing.
The idea was to get everybody on the internet. It was just get everybody on the internet. So if we do, like, as soon as we could afford to like just not charge, it was better to get scale. And AOL was the biggest, remember, Time Warner of all people.
Of course.
And so I was there, 99, top of the market, AOL, Time Warner. You know, that's why I was like, don't buy Time Warner, Netflix, please don't. It's like a curse, you know?
This AI jobs cannibalism, if you will, to a point, there's been a lot of discussion I've heard. It's almost, I've been saying that it's he who protests too much, this whole idea on out of everybody's mouth that no, we're not building this to replace employees. But meanwhile, it seems like it's happening. You know, look what happened with
We are building this to replace employees not hire them in the first place.
Correct. Right. Isn't that the truth? What is the bullshit?
The question is which employees.
Right.
And that's where I think a lot of people are making a whole big deal about the fact that this is about efficiency. See, what I'm telling my team is you better learn this. I tweeted this the other day. I direct all members of my team to work on Claude immediately. I don't care what you do. Just get on it. You know, and like the idea is we can become super advisors by having AI agents helping us do all of our work. And we do a lot of like behind the scenes work, let's say building a financial plan. And now with AI, we've already built platforms on Claude that are super awesome.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like, so we're just trying to figure out how to deploy this across the company because you literally can't even share the documents and or save data, you know? So we've got like templates that we've built that are amazing already and better than the stuff that these companies that charge us $10,000 a month for, we don't need to pay anymore. So when you're talking about employees, well, certainly if you're in what I call real work, like construction, electrical, putting in, you know, electrical infrastructure, AI can't do that.
Right.
When you're thinking about mechanical. Yeah. And you're thinking about like a lot of jobs are you physically have to exist to do those jobs. Right. And then you have this whole, this is what I was saying the other day, the generation that's graduated from college over the last decade, their degrees are worth substantially less than ours. Okay. Right. So the education system has gone down the gutter of tube of shit. Uh-huh. Okay. And what it's become is some sort of consensus building, woke, weird thing where you don't even learn the history that's actually the history anymore. Like it's the least prepared college educated people that have ever been produced by the colleges, let's say. And so now they're graduating and they're all these entitled kids who think that Facebook is everything or Instagram and that they spend half their day wasted, you know, high, just like playing on their social medias. And then they go get a job, which is basically like, how can I fuck around as much as possible and look like I'm working? And then they post this stuff online, which is even funnier. And those are the people losing their jobs and they'll never get jobs again. Because, you know, if you don't really have a skill, you're screwed because of AI. So all these kind of cushy jobs at Meta, look at what happened at Block the other day. And they 40, go, well, 50%. Block's not doing well. You know, Block's not doing well, so maybe it was just layoffs. I go, that's absolutely true. They have literally thousands of people who do nothing there, you know? And how did it get that way? Because we just hire and we hire and we hire and companies get big and they don't even realize that half the people don't actually do anything every day. And so it's going to be a tough time for college educated younger people who don't actually have real skill sets and actually didn't really learn anything of value in college.
Right. This is the story that I've always had, that if you don't know how to add and subtract, multiply and divide and understand the basics, how you can actually use that powerful Excel to its fullest. You know, if you don't understand what an average difference between a median, mean, or whatever, pick whatever.
How about if you don't understand why we're fighting in Iran right now, you should be like going back to school.
Right. Well, right.
You missed history. You just missed history.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, let's talk about that. You've been pretty vocal about the ongoing conflict there.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited.
We see this market destabilization, energy spikes.
I like it.
It's good. You like it. What part of it?
I love it.
You like the word getting rid of that
regime. I want to buy stocks. Yeah. I want to buy stocks because when this is over, like the world has changed so much for the better. There is nothing more concerning to our future than a nuclear armed Iran.
Right.
Okay.
I agree.
Honestly, it's not an opinion. It's just a fact. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not trying to say this. Like, I'm just saying that if they had a nuclear weapon right now, they would be using it. That's why we cannot let this happen. And we've played this game with them for like 20 plus years while they've attacked us and terrorized us and supported.
Lied.
I mean, it's just a million things. They played this game and they were building a weapon. Okay. I don't care what kind of propaganda nonsense you're reading online. They're building weapons. They have the ability to highly enrich uranium and they just don't give a crap about the West. And they are trying to arm up to destroy our civilization. That's a reality, okay? Then the Ukraine war starts, and they're the first people to help Russia massacre our Ukrainian brothers and sisters left and right, okay? And so, you know, then who do you think was behind October 7th? So the Arab world wants to, like, end all this nonsense, and, you know, Israel and Saudi Arabia start talking, and then they unleash this Hamas attack on Israel, which just changed everything, mm-hmm. you know? And whether Iran realized it when they unleashed October 7th that it was going to be their undoing, I'm sure they did not think that in the end, Netanyahu and the Jews would destroy them. They probably didn't. They did the old Sun Tzu era of underestimating their enemy of 5,000 years on Purim, nonetheless.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
They didn't even read the story of Purim. Okay. It's, which is about them.
Yeah. It's amazing.
So today we actually sunk a ship with a torpedo, an Iranian Navy vessel. I was like cheering. They have no Navy. They have no Air Force. And we are just systematically taking apart their entire military apparatus that have killed tens and tens and thousands of their own people in the most harsh and horrible ways. So how is the world not a better place today than it was 2 weeks ago?
Yeah. I want to also talk about, though, the traditional war footing when it comes to markets for a second, because there are, I think there's three phases, give or take. I mean, we could probably talk about this and argue about this, but there's this, you know, the initial, right? The shock. This is why things are done on the weekend. So they let it sink in a little bit, right? This is purposeful. Right.
Give them a few days.
Give a couple of days.
Maybe it'll end by Sunday night.
You know, Sunday night at about 5:58 would be very nice, Eastern time, right before futures open. You know, you get that shock. Then you get that kind of adjustment. This is the old frog boiling in a pot, right? Then you get this normalization that, okay, we're in a war. We've been in a war forever. Who cares? It's over there. The only time it really gets crazy is if I got a bomb blowing up on my doorstep. Other than that, it's over
there. Which is next, by the way, you know, in L.A.
You're closer.
No, I mean, I'm not kidding. You know, the Persian community here in L.A. is so happy. I've never seen anything like it. They're dancing in the streets.
I have Persian friends also, and they're like.
And I'm telling you, it's a risk that they're going to attack us here in Los Angeles. Between the Jewish community, the Iranian Jewish community, and the Persian community, that's just everybody here. L.A. is so happy right now, I can't even tell you. You know what I mean? And like. Everybody, so we're a target. So it's kind of what I told my kids. You know, I gave my kid, I don't let him have the phone, you know, and he's 13. I gave him the phone. I said, listen, if shit goes down, I want you having the phone because shit's going to go down. And just when they get desperate enough, they will attack. And so I think Americans need to not be complacent at this period of time. We're at war, and many of the young people today don't remember the wars that we've been fighting for the last 55 years that I've been alive. And so, you know, I'm prepared. You got to, you know, Americans need to watch out for each other right now. We got to be smart.
Let's talk about, though, what mistakes people make when wars happen when it comes to markets. Like we saw, for example, you know, the first
panic,
few days.
Right?
Yeah, they panic. They get upset because we don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty, isn't that? Is this just the same uncertainty curve as any uncertainty curve? Tariff uncertainty, new political thing, you know.
This with Trump, there's uncertainties that you can't quantify, I think market participants don't like. But if you would have told me that the market really isn't down from all this, I would have said zero chance. You know, like I Monday morning, I had my like combat gear on, you know, ready to deal with clients in panic mode. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I've done this pony, you know, that's why people pay me. I'm the guy you want in your bunker. You know what I mean? When the markets are getting killed, I've been there, done that. I'll get you through it. So I you know, my wife just doesn't understand these things. She doesn't pay attention to the news and stuff. And she's trying to act like everything's normal. I looked at her and said, we just started a war. Okay. In my business, that means we're included, you know? Right. And so like, I'm not the same today as I was yesterday. Like I have to deal with some potentially really difficult things right now. So please be supportive, you know, and so, you know, and just understand the stress I'm under because I warn my family because my job most of the time is not too bad, but these kind of times can be tough.
But what you're saying is you were surprised. You were surprised.
I'm surprised. I think the market should be down 5%, you know, maybe 10.
Right.
But when I thought from a like a rational perspective of like, what is the potential outcomes and how good or bad are they? I was like, dude, we got them all the first night.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So when I started extrapolating out 6 months from now, to me, there's the potential that this could be one of the greatest paradigm shifts in modern American history. Like eliminating the Iranian regime threat, which ultimately neuters the Russian regime threat, maybe ends the Ukrainian war. And oh my God, this would be wildly bullish, wildly bullish. And so that's why I'm saying if it goes down, I'm a buyer hardcore because I think we're going to win this war. I think Iran is just, you know, I think they're done.
Yeah.
I think the people want to be free. And if we can give them a window to somehow take over their country, it'll be messy and it'll be messy for a long time, but there's an opportunity to rejigger the world into a much better world order for everybody. And like the Middle East could become one of the wealthiest trading areas in the world. And I venture to guess that the Persian community, if they come back to their country and rebuild it, will build an amazing country.
I'm
hopeful.
Yeah. Let's pivot to another hopeful area. Let's talk about SpaceX, XAI. We'll talk about.
Yeah,
I knew that he was going to start combining those things. That was like a.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
I got out of my Twitter investment and now I own SpaceX. Right. That's the best outcome I could have asked for.
Yep. So.
Because I got screwed.
Well, but I think the valuation of what is it now? When Twitter got folded into XAI, the number that came up was like this pie in the sky number of what Twitter was worth, let's be honest. But, you know,
well, okay. It started with $44 billion for Twitter, right? Then they merged it with XAI and they said it was $110 billion.
Right.
Then they merged it with SpaceX and they said it was worth $250 billion.
Right. And then what do you say it's worth now?
Now they're saying it's worth more. Yeah. I don't know.
It says some crazy number. So
yeah,
you were very against Musk dabbling in his governmental duties of the Doge
cupola
and all that. And you're right. That
worked out well, didn't it?
Yeah, that was that whole thing was ridiculous. I mean, it was a game.
And Christine Noem is flying around on a private jet with her own bed and sleeping with the special government employee and giving her friends $150 million contracts right under Elon's nose.
Yep.
You got to love that.
The whole thing was bad. So,
poor Elon.
Are you, first of all, do you think that Tesla's going to become another division of X eventually? Of XAI, SpaceX, or whatever you want to call it at that point?
It'll be part of X. X will be the company, and it'll be multiple verticals of the future, basically. And at this point now, I think that Elon's a little bit frustrated because he wanted to get this thing out public and now we got a war. It's very hard to take companies public, you know, during conflict. And so it makes a lot of sense for Tesla and SpaceX to merge. They're basically worth the same amount of money. And then it's like they could go public through this reverse merger process kind of thing.
And if they do that, does he then get the benefit of the valuation benchmark to give him the quadrillion dollars that he was now having in his new contract? Or is that something different?
I don't know. You know, I don't know how that would affect the goals that were set for the new contract. And my assumption is that goals are goals. And so you still have to achieve those goals to achieve the pay. You know, at this point, I don't know how many goals they're going to achieve. So, you know, I don't know. I was just actually at the Tesla dealer taking my car in and there's cars everywhere and these people are working their butts off and Tesla makes great vehicles and they pretty much can drive themselves. And I just think that moving away from the vehicle sales business is a death blow to Tesla.
Their vehicle sales stink.
It stinks because they don't want to sell. They don't care.
Well, they're not
like Elon's not trying to sell cars. He is basically saying, you're going to take my cabs and we're going to build these robots and we'll sell cars too, but I don't care. I'm going to end the Model S, the best car. Every time I go over to the Tesla,
the only Tesla I would buy, by the way.
It's the best car they made.
Yeah.
The Model S Plaid with full self-driving is the best vehicle that's ever been made, and they discontinued it. And over this fluffy lie that putting a robot line in Fremont makes any sense at all, because we all know if you've ever been to Fremont, you're not putting a robot line there. It's a mess over there. Okay.
Yeah. So then the valuation of where Tesla is and the price it is in the market currently is really a factor, not of the anything to do with Tesla, really. It's just the hope for roll up into
hope X. for the future. That's when it. I talk to my Tesla clients that won't sell their shares, and I'm and you know, I approach it very delicately because they love Elon and Tesla. And I say, look, you know, what do you think of the Model S being discontinued? And, you know, they have this big dissonance that they're having a trouble with. But what they've bought into is that this future abundance with robots and cabs is the future of Tesla. And they're fine. They don't care about selling cars anymore. That's what I'm saying. They just don't care about selling cars. And that is... You have a $100 billion revenue business that was doing $15 billion a year in profit and probably worth, you know, $300 to $400 billion, right?
Yeah.
And they just are going to abandon it. So I don't know what happens, but I know nobody's buying Teslas right now.
So when you look at what they're trying to do, the Optimus ambitions and this whole issue with, you know, I don't know whether it's a scene from Sleeper. I keep envisioning this scene from Sleeper with the robots, you know, with Woody Allen with his little orb.
Yeah.
I
just go straight to like RoboCop.
Yeah, RoboCop. You know, like yeah, tattoo. And that was L.A. That was in L.A. Where do you see the limitations, the boundaries, the potential for adoption for this whole thing? And are we ready for this?
You know, first of all, getting a robot to work is really hard and to work for a long time, you know. So let's be real. We've got some time here before you, you know, I use the example all the time of my hands, you know, because I'm a guitar player, you know, the complexity of your hands and calluses and playing a musical instrument and the dexterity that humans have developed over millions of years of evolution is not that easy for them to build. And Elon will tell you that himself. And then you got eyes and you got feet. So it turns out eyes, feet, and hands make humans super unique as animals. So we're fundamentally animals, and animals adapt to millions of years of different challenges, and the animals that don't adapt die and the stronger ones survive. And we've evolved over millions of years, and most species, if you drop a human into Africa right now, humans would get eaten very quickly, and we're not adept to survive in the wild anymore. We're domesticated animals now, like a cat. And so when you think about this idea that we're going to just replace ourselves with these metal robots that think and need power, and you look at some of the incredible feats that humans do on a day-to-day basis, like that dude who just climbed that building.
That's
unbelievable. Don't underestimate the humans is what I say.
Right.
I'll bet on the humans over the robots for a long time. But now, because of what I'm reading in the military circles, what I actually believe is Tesla will be a military contractor.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. Both on the AI side and the robotics side.
SpaceX, Tesla, robotics, AI, Grok, all of it.
That's what he likes. He always likes
that. He's building an army. He's building the U.S. Army.
But isn't that what the game he always played was, to go after the highly profitable and very squishy government budgets?
There's that. I mean, Elon's been doing that since he started.
That's what I'm saying.
And then there's the Iron Man model that he kind of buys into, of like, I'm creating technologies to protect America from its adversaries. And there's no question that Starlink has been a major factor in the conflicts that we're seeing today. And so for the first time in history, we launched a drone attack using Starlink antennas in the back of the drones that we can now drive directly to the target from anywhere in the world. This is a game changer technology when it comes to the modern combat and warfare that we're seeing in the battlefield today. And then when you extrapolate out robotics and what Tesla is building and Cybertrucks, and all of a sudden you've got an army of drones, robots, and autonomous vehicles that could be extremely effective against our adversaries. So I think that argument is probably a better argument than any human wanting some stupid metal robot in their house.
I would agree with that. And then, you know, I mean, obviously there's a long, as you said, a long way. Now, what about the cyber cab? or the robo-taxi? Which is it? Is it CyberCab or robo-taxi?
I call them all robo-taxis, you know, because certainly Tesla's not the only one. I'm a Waymo user. And, you know, one of the advantages you get about living in Santa Monica is you see all the technologies before everybody else. And you see them compete. And that's how we found Tesla, was because they were here in Santa Monica. And so the fact that robo-taxis aren't even operating in Santa Monica currently just shows you how behind they are.
Right.
Because, you know, they're operating in San Francisco, supposedly, and basically Austin. But they're not robo-taxis. They're driven by drivers on full self-driving, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it's no different than an Uber driver who uses full self-driving. You see
right.
what I'm saying?
Right.
And so the promises have become a joke at this point, because by the end of the year, the people who are supposed to be out of the cars, they're not out of the cars. And there's a reason why they're not out of the cars, because the cars will kill people. And so we need the safety drivers. And I use full self-driving, you know, extensively all the time. I think that the software is better than it's ever been. I think it works really, really well. I just went to San Diego and back, and I had to disengage several times in that trip for safety reasons. And a lot of that had to do with things that are super random that just happened. Mm-hmm. Like there was a motorcycle accident in the middle of the freeway that we drove right up on. Cars were like all over the place. People were out in the freeway trying to help this guy who was hurt. You know, it was a tough driving situation. Well, humans can communicate with each other in the car. This is another thing that, you know, cabs can't do with robots. You know, it's like you wave at the person, you look at them right. so you don't hit each other. Right, right, you know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And or, so, you see where they're looking?
Well, we had to navigate around all this uh-huh. mess, you know? Right. And so, you know, fortunately I was right one of the first person, because the traffic, you know, was going to be a nightmare for the rest of the day. But, and I almost had to stop to help these people, but there was already somebody doing that. So, but that said, self-driving didn't know what to do. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so you just have to disengage, you know? And so there's a lot of scenarios now that happen in LA driving that are non-quantifiable because it's LA. And so this is what's made it very, very hard for full self-driving to work. Now, Waymo's solution, which turned out to work, is just put like tons of sensors everywhere so that we can really measure everything. And the cars don't look as good, but they work and they're safe because we know everything around us, how far it is, how fast it's going, and we're safe. So, you know, I think there's something to Tesla just like putting some sensors on the car and fixing their problem and moving on. But, yeah. you know, they're just too stubborn.
Let's talk about this getting me off of the edge of the ledge here, and talk about this whole idea where we've seen these hyperscalers, right? We've seen Amazon and Alphabet and Meta, Microsoft, NVIDIA. Well, they're not hyperscalers, but NVIDIA. All these guys spending, in your lifetime, you're going to agree with me, you've never seen spend like this. The spend is absurd. The numbers are,
The numbers are absurd.
They dwarf any, I think, any stimulus package that has ever been given out by a government. Over time.
Oh, come on. You know, Biden was sending checks to everybody. It was like $1 trillion.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know that the changing this government's going to be changing the San Andreas Fault name. Did you know that?
That's gonna be, to what?
To Biden's fault. Yeah. So
I fell for that joke.
Yeah, like, sorry.
You got me, but that was funny.
So this whole spend,
you
right?
should do that.
this whole spend that we've been hearing about, and the numbers just go on and on. And
right,
you're telling me that when NVIDIA gives money to OpenAI, and OpenAI then turns around and buys
NVIDIA chips,
NVIDIA chips, or Microsoft to OpenAI, and OpenAI buys cloud service, blah 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 blah. This is not some kind of weird deal where brilliantly you take money off your balance sheet and you turn it into income. And then you boost your EPS, and then your stock goes up.
This is like what everybody does.
This is what everybody does. This is profound.
Okay.
Though.
No, it's common in business. So now you got to share the wealth. You know, like NVIDIA can't just make $43 billion in a quarter and just like distribute it to their shareholders. Like they have customers that are spending all this money, and they want to own a piece of all these people. And if they're going to spend the money with them anyways, why not give some of it back to these guys and own a piece of all of it?
Well,
and that's what NVIDIA is smart.
But when you get a piece of it and you get like a deal with AMD, right, where Meta deploy, AMD is going to deploy 6 gigawatts of the GPUs over time, blah, blah, blah. They're going to get this money. They're going to pay for it. And then they're going to get 10% of AMD Meta. You may like that as a Meta shareholder because they basically just got free shares of AMD. But what the hell?
Well, that's what AMD has to do to get business because they're inferior to NVIDIA. And so
they gave away 10% of the company.
Yeah, I wouldn't have done that, you know, like, but that's like, we've done the analysis comparing an AMD chip to NVIDIA. It's like day and night. So, you know, they're not competitive. They've never been competitive with NVIDIA. They've always been a second tier chip company. And if I want to build GPUs with them, I'm accepting a lesser product essentially. And so why would you do that? So everybody's trying to spread the wealth and do all this stuff. But I think, you know, if you look at a company like CoreWeave, which is probably like the epicenter of where people don't like it, mm-hmm. where it's like people invest in CoreWeave, CoreWeave turns around, buys the chips, then they build a data center, and then they rent it out basically the same people, right? But, you know, you have to understand it's actually quite smart. I'll give you an example of my company. When we were starting, we needed money and we, you know, talked to LPL. We moved our business there and we said, hey, look, you know, and they said, look, we have a forgivable loan program. We'll give you XYZ if you guys do XYZ. Now, it's smart for them to give us money because we've grown to be 20 times bigger thanks with their help. It mm-hmm. helps. Mm-hmm. And so you can say, oh, they're just giving money to the same RIAs that come back and pay them. Well, that's true. But it's also now we're 20 times bigger. So it's a huge win for them. Whatever they gave us, they're making back way more. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of the calculus. It's like, if we invest in this ecosystem and we build it, like, and these companies succeed, what NVIDIA's business is going to look like in 10 years will be way more than if they just are selfish and they keep all the money for themselves and pay it all to shareholders and pay dividends and do all this shit. You know, all these companies might struggle a lot more and then they have less better customers in the future, you know? So it's smart business. You see it all over the place. Almost every industry does this where they try to support the businesses that will help them get more business down the line.
But does the increase in market cap that was based on some of these things immediately make sense? It took years for your business to grow.
Well, if you want sense, you do not trade the stock market. Okay, you trade in the stock market because you know that there isn't sense in certain areas and there's opportunity for you to make money. So there's opportunity for you to lose money too. You mm-hmm. see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so nobody forces you to buy CoreWeave. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at CoreWeave 3 or 4 times and I actually still think it's a good company, but I don't own it because I don't like the economics of investing, let's say, $50 billion into NVIDIA technology today to build data centers. Then I've got to depreciate over, let's say, 6 to 10 years. And then I have to get all this revenue into the future, which I'm sure they'll get. But it's so uncertain. It's like, how do you draw out the numbers, you know? And so that's my issue with CoreWeave. How much business are they going to get in the future? I don't know. It could be tons. I don't know. I know the demand is off the charts. But, like, do I want older chips or do I want to, like, diversify into different layers of different chips, you know, like, I don't know. So there's a lot of people doing a lot of things and some of it's not going to work for sure. But I think Zuckerberg said, I would rather overinvest. I would rather lose money on some of this than not be in the game because the game's over already. You get that, right?
Right.
Like, these are household names now. Gemini, Claude, you know, Chat. Like, my kids talk about Chat, you know, like, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Well, so if they didn't do this.
But what's interesting, Ross, is we don't know who's actually come out. And one of the things I wanted to mention is that.
No, they won already. The game's over already.
OpenAI has pledged so much money to so many companies on the come. That one in particular, right?
Well, Sam Altman's a little bit crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And the question is, are they going to be the winner in 5 years from now, 2 years from now, 10 years from now, whatever the number is, when the rooster comes to crow and has to pay up.
Well, remember who started the internet? We started this podcast. I was talking about AOL.
Right.
Where's AOL today?
Yep.
I still use it actually.
Yep. Do you? For what?
Yeah. I have my email. I have an email AOL address and I keep it because it makes me happy because it's I was the first person on the internet. I was like Al Gore.
You and Al Gore together, huh? Emailing back and forth.
Me and Al Gore.
Yeah.
I have the first AOL address. You know, like I take pride in my AOL, you know. That said, AOL is not the leader in the internet today. So will OpenAI be the leader of AI in like 30 years? I have no idea. And if you are an investor, it would probably be a mistake not to invest in these companies right now. You know, like we don't know who's going to win. I'm a big investor in Google. I think Google wins here. You know, I'm an investor in Microsoft. I think they win here. You know, I love that Google owns part of Anthropic. I would invest in Anthropic. I would invest in OpenAI.
Yeah,
I mean, see what I'm saying?
That's like, where you got Microsoft, and then you got Amazon too, of course, opening.
Right. Now, do I want to buy OpenAI at $680 billion?
No,
I don't.
Right.
But like, it doesn't change that it's not a good company, you know? But like, as I said, I think the hyperscalers have already won. It, like, if I want to be a startup AI large language model and compete against any of these models, like, how much money do I have to invest? Like, hundreds of billions. So the game's over. And so these companies knew that if they didn't go all in, you know, they had good cards. If they didn't go all in, there's very potential possibility that a third party that they don't know could have come and eaten their lunch.
Yeah.
And so this is the cost of the moat. It's the cost of the moat is $150 billion a year. And, you know, I think they're smart. I think they're smart. I think that the way the world will look 5 years from now is extremely different than what any of us can imagine.
Well, that's pretty cool. Let me ask you this on the end.
I wish I could tell you what that is. I'm not sure.
I'm going to ask you something that's a little bit shorter term as a closing question. And recognizing that we said last week we wouldn't know what's happened this week, we're not going to know what happens next week. But 6 months from now, what will investors wish they had been paying more attention to today? I mean, is it? I'm going to beat around a few things. The price of fuel, maybe the fact that we have a new the Fed is a new Fed's coming in, and that's going to be very theoretically dovish. I don't know.
I don't know if they're going to be dovish.
Is it the Nvidia comment from a couple of days ago about not spending any more on OpenAI? How about this private credit?
Well, you know, it's funny because I do a lot of these shows and I get asked a lot of the same questions. So, you know, private credit is just junk bonds that rich people bought that suck and they lose money. And that's that, you know, it's not going to infect the market because people in the market don't own it. It's just rich people. So rich people like losing money on high fee products and I'm all for it. You know, if that's what they want
to
do,
they get to talk about it.
They could just call me and I tell them not to buy it. You know what I mean?
We've been trying to get some clients out of it that we adopted some stuff for.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to get out of the stuff. That's why we don't sell it to people, because my theory is how, you know, I start with like, how do I get my money back? You know, when the private credit guys come and the VC guys and the hedge fund guys come in and pitch me, I'm always like, well, how do I get my money back? And they're like, oh, nobody ever gets their money back. You know, it's like, what?
And Ross, why do they always come in with two people in the office?
Well, they always come with two people.
Right. Am I right? It's always two.
No, you're totally right. And I always pose the same question to them. You know, we manage the client. It's a lot of effort to get the client, manage the client, get their assets under management, make them happy, service the client. And then they come to us with a 2-in-20 product.
Yeah.
And they go, well, I'm charging 75 basis points.
Yep.
And you want me to pay you 2-in-20 to buy a bunch of junk bonds.
Right.
You know? And it's like, no, why should you make 4% off my clients? You know, so you're buying garbage at 12% and you're paying them 8 and 9. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like a recycling machine. It's like a pay for recycling machine.
So we don't do that here at GK. You know, we just don't do it. Yeah. You know, every year, like even this year, all these guys come in, and then, you know, guys in my firm are like, they see all this stuff and they're like, shouldn't we be offering all this stuff? Ross, why are you so stubborn? And I said, you know why? Because when these things go bad, everybody hates you. And so I've protected you multiple times through multiple cycles of garbage products that are pitched to us, because I'm fortunately old enough to have seen many cycles of garbage products being pitched, including ones that caused the financial crisis, for that matter.
Yeah, it's funny because private credit always seemed to me to be the crap that already nobody wanted to buy, that's being bought up by the people that already, and if anything ever, if everything's fine, okay, it all goes good because they don't market, they just kind of let it
or
sit.
Or rates go down.
Yeah, or rates go down or something like that. Then they can market whoever they want. Then they don't have to remarket until some other deal, and they can do side pocketing. And then in the end, though, those are the ones that are going to have the worst problem because of liquidity issues. And they have liquidity issues, is why we have liquidity issues, right, to begin with.
Well, right. If I give you $1,000 as a loan and you're going to pay me 10%, you know, it's not bad credit if you just pay me back. So, you know, what I was saying the other day is that if you're looking to, you know, deploy capital, let's say $50 million into private credit, you know, that's probably pretty easy to do and you could hold out for good companies. But if you're looking to deploy $1 billion, you start to have to go down to the bottom of the barrel here to find investments, or else you don't get paid. You know, so much money goes into the sector, but how many high quality private companies really exist? You know, and private companies are really tough to invest in. You know, you can't get your money out easy. And, you know, what's your exit strategy? Is them going public or borrowing from somebody else to pay you back, I guess, right?
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of people that don't want to do the hard work we do at GK, like getting and managing clients, and they rather just sell products to our clients. And that's why we don't let them in, is because it's like, you lose the money, I'm the one that has to deal with it, you know, and I lose a client and you still got paid the whole way.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So we don't have that here. It's not a problem for me. And as I tell most people, I love liquidity, you know, like I learned this lesson. I mean, it's like, how old do you have to be before you just learn lessons? And one lesson that is constant is when things go bad, liquidity is a massive premium. You know what I mean? It's like, it's great to have liquidity because you can actually take action when things get bad. Like, you can now buy this private credit at 15 cents on the dollar.
And and when things go bad, it's not like, let's do a redo. Let's have a second chance. Oh, maybe let me go backwards a minute. You're in it.
That's right.
Once you're in the quicksand, you can't get out.
It's real hard to tell clients, you know, they wrote a $100,000 check for Blue Owl Fund 7.
Yep.
And then you say it's all gone.
Thank you. But
it's really hard to do that. And I'm glad I've never had to do that.
I agree. Ross Gerber Kawasaki, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Appreciate you. We're going to have all the information on how to get in touch with you on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Episode notes for number 963. Thanks, buddy.
Wow. Yeah, thank you. All right. Thanks for having me.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. That was awesome. I mean, Ross Gerber, we seem to hit it off really well, and I really enjoyed that conversation. So if you did too, send me a note, drop me a line, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button to contact us, find somewhere, something to click, send me a note, tell me what you think. I appreciate all the good feedback. I'll take the bad feedback and read it, but then probably toss it. But nonetheless, I like your feedback any way you want to send it. Thanks for joining me this week and every week. Next week coming up, we got a great guest. We got Thomas Petterfy. He is the founder. He is the guy that created. He is the current one in charge of Interactive Brokers. And quite a history and something that I'm going to enjoy. I've never really had the opportunity to speak with him before, but this is going to be a great episode. Make sure to be there next week when we bring him on. Thanks for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again real soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.